too much by way of introduction of myself, except that I'm glad that you're here, and this has been so fun for me this week to talk about some of my favorite authors that I, as I've said before, don't have a chance to talk about much. So this is great. So today we're going to look at actually some different voices. We're going to move out of New England, where we spent the last couple days, and into some different regions. And here's some different kinds of voices. I was thinking back to the first day that we met, and I think most of you were there on Monday, when I asked the question of, when you are traveling and you have a guide, what are your expectations of that guide? And people said things like they like them to take them to interesting places and have fresh discoveries, and they like them to be knowledgeable and passionate and have sort of an insider's view of where they are. And a few people said, well, I'll give you an answer, but really I'd prefer to travel without a guide at all. I'd like to discover on my own. So today we're traveling without guides in these stories. And so that will be fun, I think. And so I want you to think for a minute, and I think we'll just quickly go around and introduce ourselves again and say what you like about not having a guide.
Listen to Sally from Spokane tonight. Depends on if I'm in an English-speaking country or a foreign country. In a foreign country, I much prefer to have a guide. When we went to England with my daughter, we discovered going on tours was much more helpful to learn about a place like a castle or a cathedral than just trying to do it on our own. Mm-hmm. So if we were familiar with something, we didn't need a guide, but if we weren't, then we wanted it.
My name is Leon, and I've never really had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling. The furthest I've ever been was Hawaii, and we were on our own there. But there's not much you can do on Maui anyway.
You can't get too far.
So I think if I were to ever travel anywhere other, I would prefer having a guide. But that was fun kind of looking around myself, too.
Yeah, because what's fun about it?
You can find kind of discover on your own,
yeah.
And most times you'll find anything of interest is already marked, and so you have you can read and find out what's going on there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My name is Kay, and the advantage that I think of not having a guide is that you don't have strict timetables. Mm-hmm. If you get to something interesting, you can stay 2 hours. Not have to meet the group at a certain time.
Yeah, so you can linger over things that are of more interest to you than others. And yeah, there's something to be said for that lingering and just sitting in a spot for a while. Yeah.
I'm Gloria Bank, and I'm from Puyallup, Washington. Reflect some of the same things that people said. We had the opportunity to live in China for several years, and there a guide was helpful a lot of times, but in China, it was kind of a unique thing because if you'd stand on the corner and look confused or not know, there were always people who wanted to practice their English and would invite you to your homes and find out a lot of things because they weren't as interested in me practicing my Chinese as they were practicing English. So you kind of got a mix of both of those wonderful worlds of being with a guide or just going on your own too. And the question was, what do you like about not having a guide? Not having a guide is the time. New to what people have said, but the freedom.
I think what I like is that you can avoid tourist traps. I think someone said that before. You can. I remember one time in Scotland, driving down this road that we got stuck behind a herd of sheep, and this little roller skate of a car, and there were stone walls all around that were just ancient, but I thought, I'll never forget that. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't be something I don't think you would do on a tour, a guided tour. We did a lot of other strange things that were so memorable, and just because we were on our own and we got kind of lost. Mm-hmm. And in someone said, in getting lost, you can have some really good adventures.
Hi, I'm Leanne Peters, and I'm
from Rochester, Minnesota, and I think it's the element of surprise, you know, for your own self-discovery, whether it is something that isn't really, I mean, might be kind of touristy or whatever, but for you it's new,
mm-hmm.
especially if you if it's a different place that you haven't been to before, so that's what I like.
Hi, I'm Donna Rasmussen, I'm also from Rochester, Minnesota, and I think my biggest thing was the timetable of, you know, if you go on a guided tour, it's from 1 to 2,
yeah.
and you maybe have a minute to read something along the way, but you don't really have the time to spend looking or reading about,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, especially if it's there's a like a sign that talks about it. Where if you go on your own, you can go to the things that interest you, and maybe on a guided tour, there are things that maybe you're not as interested in, but if you go on your own, you can
mm-hmm.
spend more time on the things that you're
yeah.
interested in.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Tracy from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I think the spontaneity, you know, following the rhythms of a family, if you have kids, kind of what they can do. And, you know, do we need to rest, or do we want to spend more time here, or what's interesting to us right now?
Scott from Sioux Falls, let's see here, I guess I prefer one, to have a guide to give you the high points, but two, without the guide, you have the opportunity to not feel like a tourist,
mm-hmm.
and you're not following the person with the flag, and you're not being herded
like
through.
And
so you get to kind of stop and have lunch where you want to, and you know you find those nooks and crannies that you wouldn't otherwise find.
I'm Emily from Minneapolis. And I think some of the trips I've done, like I did a bike trip with a friend in Portugal and Spain,
mm-hmm.
and it's not until you're in trouble or vulnerable that people help you. Like, if you're on a tour guide, no one stops and helps you, but if your tire's flat by the side of the road and somebody comes along, you have a whole new experience. That vulnerability is both scary and exciting.
Right, and it's similar to what you were talking about, of standing looking lost and somebody comes and says, let me help you.
How about Dick Berry, Isle of Heart Mission? I'm here because my wife's in the city. But anyway,
you taking notes for her?
I haven't heard anything yet. I found that a mixture of guiding and free time allows us to be pointed in certain directions that aren't going to be covered by the guide,
yeah.
and the free time would be allowing us to have the freedom. But after my wife died in 1990, I discovered I missed a guide, I missed a companion.
Mm-hmm.
So traveling alone held no appeal to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a side.
Yeah, but that's an interesting.
Because there's no one to share with.
Yeah.
And part of travel is sharing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Companionship. I think we'll want to hold that notion of companionship in mind
mm-hmm.
today. Yeah, that's a great.
There's a risk too. I mean, I've been in places where I've been really uncomfortable because I went the wrong direction when I came out of the train station or off the bus,
yes.
and be surrounded by a total foreign situation
yeah.
and feeling like I was really out of my element, so, or wasting a lot of time because I didn't plan better. I went way up north and way back down. You know, a lot of wasted travel time when I could have planned better.
Yeah.
But it's I just wanted to say how there are a lot of good people in the world,
yeah.
you know, who, if you get that dazed look in your face, like we've asked many times, they'll stop and say, can I help you? And but the planning is also important.
When I was a college student, I was in the choir at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, and we took a trip to New York City when I was a freshman. And there, we had some free time, and there was a group of us young college women who decided to go off together, about 8 of us, and I cannot count the number of times that people would say, are you from the Midwest? We must have all just been like here and then like the whole time over there. But they were so willing to help us out, and I mean, we must have looked terribly lost and out of place, but yeah. And one of the exercises I do with my students when I teach literature at Augie is to have them think about the differences between being a traveler and being a tourist. And those kind of epiphanies and discoveries that you make when you're a traveler, as opposed to sort of being stuck on the tour bus and seeing everything, you know, go by you, and you have to sort of make quick judgments and quick, you know, interpretations of things, and often don't even have time to make an interpretation because you're with the guide who's telling you what to think and what to see and what to look at, versus being a traveler who really gets off the bus and lives there and lingers there. And I invite my students to do that as a way of reading. I tell them I want them to be travelers when they're reading literature rather than tourists, and really get in, you know, stomp around on the ground of the story and have lunch with the characters and, you know, really get to know them. And I think they find that a useful way of thinking about reading, the ways of interpreting that, rather than deciding that there's only one way to understand something, but to really consider the many different ways to explore a piece of writing. So, today we're going to look at a move that happens in regionalism, which is to eliminate the narrator. And certainly up until that point in writing there, and of course, well, up until that point there was almost always a narrator. And what is the purpose of a narrator generally? What does a narrator do?
Outlines what's going on.
Outlines what's going on.
Yeah.
They inform.
Point of view.
It's a point of view. And often a very particular point of view, and you as the reader are in a lot of ways forced to see that same way, right, as the narrator does. Other things that a narrator does.
So would a narrator, maybe repeating just what you said, make a character more one-dimensional because we are seeing that character through the eyes of the narrator, rather than sitting down with them and having a sense of them in a more well-rounded way?
Can. I mean, they sort of choose which characters they want to present to you as a round, fully developed person, and which character they show you as sort of one-dimensional. You can't really have a story of all round characters, or you'll just get too muddled up and lost. But and certainly up to this point, when regional writing sort of emerged, the narrator was a teacher and a preacher, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, the narrator was the moralizer, the one who told you what you were supposed to learn from this story, what Christian, you know, tenets you were supposed to get out of this story. Think of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? I mean, there's a very preacherly, teacherly didactic.
It's almost manipulative,
voice.
Emotional.
It is almost manipulative, yeah, you certainly.
But it's a small, little, tiny girl. Is so sick.
Yes, exactly.
You gotta feel sorry for them.
Exactly. Now, and I mean, all of this is sort of theoretical because, of course, there's a narrator even when there isn't a narrator. You know,
right.
I mean, the writing doesn't just sort of come out of nowhere. I mean, obviously, there's an author behind the text, but this interesting move happens where the author eliminates the narrator, and so then here we are with the character.
And you get inside their heads a lot better.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, we'll take a look at a couple examples today and sort of see how that functions and how that works on us as readers, too. So the first piece that we're going to look at is written by Alice Dunbar Nelson. Anybody familiar with her? How about Paul Lawrence Dunbar? Mm-hmm. Heard of him? She was married to him. He became more famous. As a writer, he was a poet, but Alice Dunbar Nelson has this interesting background. She grew up in New Orleans. She was the daughter of a slave. Her mother was a slave, and we think she was probably mixed Indian and African heritage, her mother. And her father sort of wasn't around, so we don't know much, but we think that he was a white Creole. So she has this interesting, Alice Dunbar Nelson herself has this interesting racial background. And her stories often, though not the one we're going to look at today, but her stories often have characters who are passing, which means that they are of at least some African American descent, but they look white enough to pass. And so she deals a lot with that, although she's also very careful when she writes about her own writing to say that she isn't writing about the Negro issue at that time. That would be the word they would have used. But she's not concerned about that. She's concerned about the character, right? But there's an element of that sense of passing. And she is writing about her home region of New Orleans, and her husband, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, said to her in a letter when they were courting, he said that he called New Orleans a kind of romance land,
mm-hmm.
ripe with opportunity for the local artist. He said its very atmosphere must teem with stories, and its streets and byways be redolent of dramatic incident that lingers as a sort of perfume from a fragrant past. And Alice Dunbar also thought that was all lovely and flowery and fine, but that was not the New Orleans she wanted to show. She didn't want to present this romantic view of New Orleans. She wanted to show the real.
And about what year did they live?
In New Orleans?
I mean, what year are we talking about? 1850s, 60s, 70s?
18, let's see, that letter was written in 1896.
Oh, more recent.
So yeah,
okay.
Almost at the turn of the century, and the story we're going to read is 1899, so
okay.
Just before. And so she said in a letter to him that she hadn't much liking for those writers that wedge the Negro problem and social equality and long dissertations on the Negro in general into their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Then she said, somehow when I start a story, I always think of my folk characters as simple human beings,
mm-hmm.
not as types of a race or an idea, and I seem to be on more friendly terms with them,
mm-hmm.
she says. So, I mean, she is definitely trying to get across a sense of real people.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, I will give you her story. It is on the first page of this handout, so you don't need to turn the page.
Your phrase, real people, brings a chuckle to me. Periodically you'll see a TV ad. These are not actors. These
yeah.
are real people.
Exactly. Now this, I will tell you a couple things before you get too far into this. This is thick in dialect, in Creole dialect. So you'll see some French words, or I don't even know if they're strictly French, they're probably more Creole. And I've tried to put in brackets a translation for words that I thought might be unfamiliar. And then she shifts pronoun usage when she's talking about, particularly when she's talking about a female child, she sometimes says his or him or he,
mm-hmm.
but it's still the female child, so don't let that confuse you, but that's how that is. So.
Don't look.
Enough of that. I'll let you just read.
So it's not typo, it's just...
It's not typo, it's really... It's
what
really
was
related.
English your first language, the author?
Yeah, well, Creole English, I think.
What was Creole came from French and Indian?
French and Indian, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another name and it got shortened to that one term.
Yeah,
it was a...
And Cajun, too.
Cajun, that's right,
yeah.
Yeah.
From
yeah.
Canada.
Okay,
yeah,
yeah but the
word,
yeah, then.
Yes, you may read.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. which serves what purpose?
Where you are.
Here we are, and here's the character, and then gone.
Then she takes over. Yeah.
Pretty
it's
much.
It's all totally her words, too.
Yep. Yep, and hold on to that. We'll get back to that in a minute. So, and then one more time, the narrator steps in to say, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, chimes the cathedral bell across Jackson Square, and the prowling woman crosses herself. What? Is that necessary in the story? What purpose does that serve? It gives us a little break from the dialect, right? But there's more.
Roman Catholic.
Okay, probably.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. So it definitely suggests a religiosity to the praline or praline, or there's so many different ways of pronouncing that word. That there is a sense of faith in religion. Anything else that little line does?
Well, it gives you a picture of the cathedral in the background and her setting, selling the pralines, which is very common.
Yes.
Still to this day.
Yes, right. And we were just in New Orleans in April and walked by Jackson Square, and there people are selling their things and reading poems and all that stuff.
That mix.
Right there. So the narrative voice really is in there merely to sort of situate the reader, right? And to situate the character in a particular place and in a particular way. Do you see, even though, as Lucinda pointed out, the it's all now, other than that, it's all the probably woman's words, is there a narrative stance? Is there any direction for us as readers as to how
well,
we are
you
supposed
catch
to...
catch this thing that she's constantly giving away pralines instead of selling them.
Okay.
And she's interacting with people as they come and letting them know about her dead children and finding out from them that they have dead children. And so this is a constant thing. And she crosses herself and she feels sorry for anyone who's lost anyone, and she gives them a praline. Or gives them a praline to taste.
Mm-hmm.
And then she talks about having adopted the child, and the child now cleans for her and makes the pralines for her. So you have a sense of she really wants to be social and wants to interact with everybody that walks by, not merely to sell, but also to interact, to make contact.
Okay. But interesting that Denbar Nelson doesn't give us the other half of the conversation, right? We just get hers.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a sense of what the customers are saying to her based on her response. And she's kind of filling in the gaps of between their comments and her comments. In the gap there is her story, right? So we get a really decent sense of what her life has been, right?
Mm-hmm.
That she's lost two children and that she now has this adopted daughter and that her life has really been a selling.
Mm-hmm.
Pralines. And what else do we learn about that, about her livelihood?
It's the daughter that makes it.
Yeah, she is no longer able to make them herself. So she is completely dependent upon this adopted daughter, right? And what mercy, right? And what blessing that she was able to find this little girl who is able to sort of keep her alive, really. You know,
she seems to be caring about people, except with the Indian squaw. She has no use for that Indian
until
squaw.
Until she comes and then she talks to her.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing too, right? That we talked yesterday about the gaze, right, and observation. So we'll talk in a minute about how sort of we're situated as the reader. But we are certainly looking in on her.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have these moments where she is observing right, the Indian squaw and commenting on her. And then there's another section that I didn't give you. It's very brief, where an Irishman walks by and she has much to say about her. So I thought maybe there would be Irish folk here and it might be offensive. So she has these sort of two commentaries on these other types, right? And she is a type as well, although Denbar Nelson, as I quoted for you earlier, is careful to not present her characters as types, and that's not her intent, certainly. The Indian squaw, she has this moment. And then she also doesn't like the woman who doesn't buy one. she curses her, right? So you take none, no husband for you then.
Yes.
So you just keep on moving, and I hope you have no husband for you. So, you know, she's an interesting character in many ways. So, what about empathy? How does empathy work in this story, if at all?
With Madame, that she later says no husband for you, she tries to ingratiate herself to her and say how this little girl with his little hands and made them, and tries to elicit sympathy for that.
Okay.
And then when she's rejected, she just rejects like that.
Yeah. So empathy, in some ways, for her is a means of survival, right? If she can elicit empathy or at least sympathy from her customers,
mm-hmm.
then
mm-hmm.
they are more likely,
right,
to buy from her. Right? So there is that.
Any salesman recognizes that you don't have a potential sale until the person responds to something you say or do.
Yeah.
Now you've got a personal relationship,
right,
which can lead to sale.
Mm-hmm.
But if they won't even acknowledge your presence,
yeah,
no potential at all.
Yeah. And so, yeah, acknowledging presence. So
that's the free examples, too, as a way of getting them to stand still a minute interact a minute,
you
better
yeah.
chance with the potential for.
And see her, right? As you say, you have to be seen, right? But it isn't just about seeing that I'm sitting here selling my pralines. It's what? In what way do they want? In what way does she want them to see her?
As a grieving mother.
Yeah, as a grieving mother.
And as a Catholic, because she's right next to. And talks about what a good Catholic she is. She brings that in too. She's right next to the Archbishop's little chapel, so expecting people going there would probably be Catholic
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that situate, I mean, who are those people then who are going to church?
Well, they're Catholics probably.
Probably.
Just a mere mix of people.
Yeah. And probably us, really,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah.
Probably that, I mean, we aren't going to really identify with
mm-hmm.
praline women as the reader, right?
No, but I'd sure like some of her pralines.
I know.
I'd get some of her.
Right?
Really, it's this.
Yeah.
Your dad.
But we are the people walking by,
yeah.
right? We
yeah.
are the people going to church, and we are the people from whom she is hoping
to get her,
mm-hmm.
hook us in.
For something, to hook us in, right. Well, she's not going to get money from us as the reader, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what will she get from us?
Attention.
Empathy. Right.
And then
what happens when empathy occurs? So she expresses empathy for her customers as well.
Yeah, she
right?
does. That's great.
She never lets them answer. so she might have better sales if she just shut up
yeah.
and let them.
She talks too much.
Yeah, she talks too much.
This may be her only social contact.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the little girl,
yeah.
It probably is. Right?
And so she's inducing conversation in a variety of ways, sometimes by cursing, sometimes by explaining her deaths of her child or children.
This almost makes me tired. I mean, I think that she's working very, very hard through this, with this contact with each person that goes by with this conversation,
mm-hmm.
in order, I'm sure, to sell, to be empathic in relationship with them in some way. But as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, oh man, you're working hard.
Yeah. And do you feel like the author is working too hard?
I don't know if you read more, depends on whether her style continues this way or not.
Yes.
I mean, it could be just a setting for this particular
It
book
is. I mean, she has other stories where it's more of
more
an
space.
Actual story.
And you might
space.
Get more, I mean, as she goes on with the story, maybe she
This is it.
Off.
I mean, that's
the
end.
That's
yeah.
it. Oh,
this
is the whole
thing.
Oh.
I mean,
I thought it was an introduction.
I know.
Too. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got
the whole thing. Other than that one little section of the Irishman that I took out.
Oh, this is the whole thing.
This is the whole thing.
Oh my goodness.
So this is all me.
she, but she has no sense of boundaries. That she unloads all of her issues with everybody that walks by and tries to get information from them as a way of feeling alive.
I would so walk around her.
I would probably want to engage with her, but my husband would be pulling me down the street. Yeah. Come on, let's go.
And $15. So, but that notion of boundaries is interesting because isn't that sort of what regionalism suggests, okay, right? That there are boundaries.
Yeah.
And that in the And that a region is a place that is bordered and kind of sectioned off in some way from the larger world, right? And so this notion that she has no boundaries, that she's working so hard to cross the boundary, right, and to put herself out there in connection with another human being, right? Any human being.
Children.
You're a stranger, she says to someone. I can tell you're not from around here, but. And so, can I talk to you, right? This sense of like.
I almost feel sorry for the little adopted girl.
Yeah, I don't know how to
relate
to her.
She had no one, though, that little girl,
right,
too,
sure,
right? So,
oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
we definitely get a sense that, I mean, if you were, so we have this narrative moment where we're told that she crosses herself, which would indicate that she's praying, right? And a couple scholars have talked about, they've used the word praline in an interesting way, and they've talked about it as praline, right? That there's a praline, but also a pray, P-R-E-Y line, right?
Oh.
That she's praying on the customers in some way. So part of the question is, do you see her as a genuine person who really does have empathy for her customers and their situation, or do you see her as using sort of a feigned empathy in order simply for economic
survival?
It's
so pressured. She's so constantly patter, 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 that you feel like it's a,
mm-hmm,
she has no control over it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I think it's hard for us because she's in desperate straits, and most of us haven't been in that kind of poverty. She's got to provide for that little girl and herself.
Mm-hmm.
She'll use anything she needs,
yeah,
to do that, but I think the fact that she took the little girl and shows us that she is a caring person.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you were saying, that need for some kind of human connection,
mm-hmm,
that's as important to survival, right, as the money that she earns by selling the cravings.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this interesting intertwining of empathy being used both for economic survival and just for sheer survival of being a human being who needs connection. Who needs companionship, right? On this road.
So there's a neediness,
mm-hmm,
in all of this. I think that,
mm-hmm,
is what I'm kind of
yeah,
cute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the way that we are drawn in as the reader, right? Whether we're sort of repelled by it, resistant to it. Right. Yesterday we talked about feeling dislocated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we would maybe want to dislocate ourselves from this woman who is just jabbering away. And yet, in some ways, we are really forced to look at her, aren't we,
yeah,
when we read this story?
Mm-hmm.
We have to see her, and we have to hear her story. Mary Pellauer is a nun. and she, how many of you are familiar with Kathleen Norris's book, Dakota? That's a current work of regionalism, really, right? And the subtitle of that book is A Spiritual Geography. She talks about how place really shapes who we are as people. But she quoted Mary Pellauer. I'm seeing it. And no, this is just kind of connected, I think. Mary Pellauer has said, if there is anything worth calling theology, it is listening to people's stories, listening to them, cherishing them. Right? So if there is anything that we can call theology, it is listening,
mm-hmm,
to people's stories. And I think that's what's going on largely in this praying woman's story, is that listening. And her story fills in the gaps, and we, even though we're bantered with her sales pitch, we also listen to her story.
Her little story about her son and how she even prayed for him and did all these things for him. So she's had a crisis of faith, too, that he died anyway.
How old do you think the little girl is? I'm trying to picture how old she is. She's got little hands. Is she
little hands, but able to cook.
Able to cook.
8 to 10, something like that.
Yeah, but of course, poverty, people are more capable earlier, so she can have the young side of that.
But she plays guitar and sings, so that would make her a little older.
Yeah, they all do.
The other thing, I want to say one more thing, because Lucinda mentioned that she really, and we need to talk about the ending story. The whole text is her voice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this interesting idea of the text being completely connected to a speaking voice.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't have a narrator, that's what you get, is the speaking voice, right? And her voice only disappears at the end when what happens?
Rains.
Like, I mean, you kind of get an image of it being kind of a deluge, right? Like a downpour. And what, I mean, what illusions might that pull up for you? That downpour at the end.
Coming up to Holden the other day.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, and that's our context, right, for that. If we think of New Orleans and we think of that, and we've seen pictures of that, right, and how that water and that flood just swept people away. And you sort of get that sense of that at the end of the story, that she's kind of being swept away, and you hear crawlings, like it's getting farther and farther in the distance.
People are running there in the street anymore, and probably,
yeah.
And
so then thus endeth her story, right? When she can no longer speak, when she no longer has anybody to listen to her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What does she have to say, really, at that point? What, the need to say something is not present if there isn't a listener, right?
I really appreciated this in your conversation, as you said, about approaching something like this with a real generosity of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, I mean, I really kind of made a judgment, like, I would give her, because I don't like to stand and talk or like wait for it. But, an openness to stay with the character,
mm-hmm.
even though they can be somewhat, repellent, to hear their story and to understand. It's really, I appreciate that.
I visited my sister in Texas once, and she knew the coffee person by first name, and I mean all these things that she do over the course of the day. I never would engage clerks and things like that. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting.
I get on an airplane, face the window.
Well, that's happened for everybody. Everybody's plugged in now.
Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick look, I guess, at this second piece. I'm delighted that. So much conversation. This other one is by a Native American author, Zitkala Shah, is the name she chose for herself. She was christened Gertrude Simmons Bonin, but she grew up on the reservation in the Yankton Sioux Agency, so South Dakota, my home place. And she lived on that reservation for 8 years, and at that point in time, a group of white men from the east came, and they were collecting children from the reservation to take back east to educate them.
Mm-hmm.
And she volunteered to go.
This is the real person.
This is the real person. She wanted to go. She decided that she wanted to, at the age of 8, be educated. And so she went on the big iron horse, she called it, the train, out to Indiana. And she went to school there, she has a collection of stories called School Days of an Indian Girl. School Days of an Indian, I think is what it's called. And she talks about her experiences there as they tried to take the native out of her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Beginning by cutting her hair and making
Did she
hair.
Have a choice? You said she volunteered.
She chose. And her mother did
they
not want
them
her to go.
Without a choice.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes. And her mother did not want her to go, but she insisted, and so her mother allowed her to go. They cut her hair, they made her wear shoes, they made her wear, you know.
We did this to civilize.
Yes.
So how long was she gone?
She was gone for a couple of years, and then she came back one summer to the reservation, and at that point discovered that she fit in neither place.
Oh my God.
And now she no longer was sort of part of the American culture, but she was also very resistant to completely assimilate in white culture. So she has this very interesting approach to, you know, just being nowhere, you know, having no place, which makes her an interesting writer for regionalism. But this story comes out of a collection called Impressions of an Indian Childhood. It's the impressions of those first 8 years of her life. I think that word impressions is interesting as a narrative stance too, because what does it mean to give your impression of something?
It's usually superficial.
Could be superficial.
It's subjective.
It's very subjective. I think you take ownership when you say this is my impression of something, right? And I think that's a way of saying you don't have to see it this way, right? This is my impression.
Yeah.
And so I think her choice of word entitling her collection that way in and of itself sort of takes the narrator out. And she is, we think, the first Native American woman to be published as a writer. She was able to do it because she learned English so well and so quickly.
Was she able to make any money, or how was her life?
She did really well as a writer.
Wow.
She was published in Harper's and Atlantic Monthly, big-time literary magazines, and she became an activist, you know.
Wow.
And for this time, that is really something.
Yeah.
I wonder when she died.
She's an when she died. In 1938.
But this was written in 19. This is when this was written.
Mm-hmm.
1900. Yes. That one
was not too old when she died. Yeah. So she's a really interesting character in and of herself, right?
Yeah.
I'll
look her up.
Yeah. I would encourage you to do that. And she says in a letter that she wrote in 1901, shortly after this story was published, she says, "As for my plans, I do not need to give up my literary work, but while the old people last, I want to get from them their treasured ideas of life. This I can do by living among them."
Wow.
So she goes back to the reservation. "Thus I mean to divide my time between teaching and getting story materials." So she was a teacher as well.
On the reservation?
No.
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 Mm-hmm. Regular?
No, she was never really able to go back to live on the reservation. Once she had left, it
stayed in Indiana then?
Yeah, kind of in that area. But this idea of living among them and using that, people have called her a transitional writer. She, like Alice Dunbar Nelson, she could not pass. She was most definitely Native American, and so assimilation was difficult for her in that way as well. I will let you just go ahead and sit with that story, and then we'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I love how she does the switch from the little girl being afraid of the crazy man and being left alone in the teepee to it being Grandpa who tells her stories. And that's something, you really feel that change. And then you've got the same sort of thing happening when she presents this careful meal as the perfect hostess, and it's really just really sad, but nobody says a thing. They pretend, and they don't make her feel badly about it. And later she realizes, oh.
Isn't that beautiful?
It
how they don't direct her or
so
shame
sweet.
Her, or you know,
right.
just
they
kind of giggle about it together, but you know, they just
honor
her efforts.
And yet they laugh about it too when she's there. They laugh.
Yeah,
she made me this coffee on the cold ashes.
On the ashes.
But it wasn't really your grandpa, probably.
No.
I like
just
that.
Somebody
that she called
I know
her.
The respect given both
right.
from the grandfather to her and from her to the grandfather.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
As was their custom.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
It is.
I really like the way they treated the person who was mentally ill, too, you know, and with all of our big knowledge and years, you know, how we shut people away in asylums and everything, and now we got all these folks in the community, and we have a situation in our church where people are fearful of this one paranoid, schizophrenic, dark-skinned woman we're having an issue with, because my husband's an advocate for her, and the rest of the people are like, you know, so it's very interesting how they were just accepting him and understanding of him and let him come and go, just like we try to do sometimes with people.
But I do remember as a little child having this kind of fear.
It's natural.
Yeah.
I think it's natural as adults to be fearful of people that are different.
Yeah.
And so that shift that she makes of telling about that fear and then having this. The other thing that's interesting in that is that who tells her the story of the interesting character, her mother, right? And that's kind of a thread throughout her whole collection of impressions, is that her mother is the storyteller. And so you get a sense that she really grew up with this idea that women are storytellers, that women hold the stories, and that she can do that. I mentioned that she's called a transitional writer, and part of that is because that the Native American culture is a very oral storytelling culture, right? And now she puts it down in written form. So she's transitioning into that, but what she risks by doing that is sort of alienating her own Native American culture by putting their oral storytelling into written form, you know. And so she's just interesting in those kinds of ways.
There was quite a time period back in the late 1890s where social educators and religious people were going to civilize these people and ship them off to different locations. They literally could no longer speak their language. And it just...
It's like a lost generation.
Well, they're only now trying to rediscover their past.
Yeah.
And so polluted with our version of truth.
It wasn't very long ago that I heard a piece on NPR where they were talking about an Indian school, and that school was just now making sort of reparation payments to those now adults, but children who had, you know, suffered tremendously. I mean, they were just cruel to them, hate them.
Or with the best of intentions.
It was the idea that science could cure everything and make a more perfect society.
Yes.
It happened in Australia too with the Aborigines.
Yes.
All over the world.
Yes.
All over, yeah. The thing about the odd person, the crazy person actually having an evil spirit, reminds me of the book about the spirit touched me and I fell down, about the mom who come to this country and the child has epilepsy and faces medical things want to cure, and the parents don't speak English so well, and there's this big clash, and it's a fascinating study, because in their culture, the epileptic is touched by the spirit, and is like a shaman, like a holy person, and there's a whole different attitude about it, and you think of past societies where someone who's crazy was touched by God, and in the Bible you hear about people who have special powers and can prophesy and things like that.
I like the way she must have come to an understanding with her mother,
because she left it really on her own. Her mother didn't want her to go, and now she's